It is Thursday, October 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the investigation into the deadly shooting in Las Vegas continues. A Japanese-born British author wins the Nobel Prize for Literature. And country music fans take a second look at gun control following the Las Vegas shooting. It's all ahead. The investigation into the worst mass shooting in U.S. history continues in Las Vegas. I'm joined by VOA's Carolyn Pursuti, who is in the Nevada City, for more details. Carolyn, what is the latest? What has been found out about additional hotel rooms that the suspect Stephen Paddock apparently rented out in the in the days around this attack?
Sarah, good morning to you. That's right. It's amazing what the police have come up with. They have found that he had rented a hotel room over another concert venue last weekend. So now they're trying to piece together if he had another plan that went haywire somehow, and he wasn't able to carry out that plan. Or maybe they think that could have been a dry run for the Mandalay Bay attack. They really aren't sure. And, you know, the big question in this entire investigation is about motive. They really don't know why he carried out this horrific attack. They have talked to his girlfriend, his live-in girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley. She returned from her overseas trip. They met her at the airport. FBI agents have been questioning her, hoping to get answers. But through her attorney, she has said she knew nothing of his plan. She actually described him as a kind, caring man, which is far from the man that we all think he was after he shot from the 32nd window here into a crowd of 22,000 concert goers.
Well, yeah, and apparently in the last year, he had accumulated a number of weapons.
Oh, absolutely. How many weapons he can buy at one time, and just the fact that he had 23 in his hotel room. Yesterday, I spoke with several security guards at hotel rooms around the Las Vegas Strip, and they tell me that they instituted a plan to have metal detectors at every entrance for Monday and Tuesday, but then they eased up yesterday because they didn't feel the need to check all of their customers. And I said, well, are you checking bags at all? And they said, we're checking huge bags. We're checking those golf club bags and making sure that there are indeed golf clubs inside, because that is the million-dollar question. How did he bring 23 long guns into his hotel room without any suspicion? And beyond that, how did he purchase so many guns without bringing up suspicion? And, of course, one of the answers to that is that he purchased them in multiple locations in different states.
And then I believe police also think, even though he ended up killing himself, that he apparently did plan an escape route. And they also, some officials have questioned whether he did have any help with all this.
Absolutely. Two big questions there. And the thing that made police think that he had an escape route were those cameras outside, out in the hallway and in his door, in his keyhole for his door. He wanted to know when the police were coming so that he could exit. So we really don't know if he thought that police wouldn't have responded en masse, or if he truly believed that he would get out of this situation, which to us seems beyond any common sense, that we knew that the SWAT team would respond and just end up on that floor and just bombard his room with gunfire, which they did. But also what is shocking is how many rounds of ammunition he had inside that hotel room. So he had planned on carrying out even a larger massacre than occurred on Sunday night here in this town.
Just horrifying. Thanks very much, Carolyn. That's VOA's Absolutely. Carolyn Pursuti in Las Vegas. here some of the top news stories that are trending. The top candidates to lead South Africa's ANC both have drawbacks. U.S. lawmakers are urging action in Myanmar. The U.S. military confirms three soldiers were killed in Niger, and a deadly suicide attack hits a Sufi shrine in Pakistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has awarded this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry. It's the third and final Nobel Science Award for 2017. The new Nobel laureates are Jacques Dubuchet from the University of Lausanne, Switzerland, Joachim Frank from New York's Columbia University, and Richard Henderson, who is with the MRC Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, England. The trio of scientists won the prestigious prize for their work in developing cryo-electron microscopy. This innovative technology allows researchers to freeze biomolecules in mid-movement and view their never-seen-before functioning processes. It's thought that this technology will provide scientists with better understanding of life's chemistry and help them develop new and more effective pharmaceuticals. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, country music fans react to the recent violence in Las Vegas. British author Kazuo Ishiguro has been awarded the 2017 Nobel Prize in Literature. The 62-year-old author was born in Nagasaki, Japan. He moved to Britain when he was 5 years old. Ishiguro has written numerous novels, but the committee said on Twitter that his most celebrated work was The Remains of the Day, a story about a butler at an English country estate. I spoke with Philip Langeskov, a lecturer in creative writing at the University of East Anglia, where Ishiguro studied.
First of all, we are absolutely delighted, thrilled. In terms of his characteristics, what makes him unique, one of the things that makes him unique, I think, is that his work is enormously varied. He's a restless writer who doesn't sort of rest on the successes of his previous books or try to imitate their style. He looks to change genre, to change style, to change approach on a book-by-book basis. So his works move from dealing with notions of a historical past in books like A Pale View of the Hills or The Remains of the Day to speculative fictions like Never Let Me Go, and then most recently he's moved into fantasy with The Buried Giant. So it's hard to pin down what is unique about his work, but what I would say a characteristic of his writing throughout his career is this really genuinely remarkable sense of control of tone and measure, the way that language unfolds both on the page and in the ear. And alongside that, there's this preoccupation with the operation of memory, what we remember, how that remembering might transform or shape us. Those are two significant aspects of his work, but perhaps most significant for me as a reader and as an admirer of his work is the way that he captures the sense of the double lives that all of us live. There's the life that we live on the streets, you might say, you know, the life of everyday reality, of observable fact and physical appearances. But at the same time, we're each of us living the life of the mind, which is made up of dreams and imagination, half-thoughts and speculations. And those two different ways of living are quite different, but they happen at exactly the same time. They coexist in our experience of the world. And I think he captures that in a way quite unlike any other writer that I can think of. And I think as a consequence of that, even in its everyday mundanity, the lives of his characters seem strange, beguilingly so, and always a little bit disturbing, a little bit frightening.
Well, he's had a very interesting life, and he was born in Japan, and I believe he lived there as a small child, but then moved with his parents to the UK. What are kind of the influences of both countries on his writing?
I guess it's a little hard to speak about that on his behalf, but we do know that he was born in Nagasaki in 1954, that he moved to England at the age of five, and he didn't return to Japan until 1989. Nonetheless, I think it is possible to see an identification between certain Japanese social and cultural inheritances and certain British ones. I sort of advance these theories slightly hesitantly, but you might say that both those societies underwent in the years following World War II a move from being sort of quite buttoned up societies bound by certain social conventions and codes of behavior being much more open and fluid societies. And a lot of his work deals with the sort of fallout from that change in social behavior. It's very evident in The Pale View of the Hills or An Artist of the Floating World from a Japanese perspective. It's equally evident in his most famous novel, The Extraordinary Portrayal of Stevens, the butler in The Remains of the Day, who, as a consequence of being bound by certain social conventions, a sense of loyalty and service, sort of completely unable to speak his true feelings. The consequence of that is almost unbearably, and I really mean it when I say almost unbearably, unbearably moving account of somebody who is unable to live a fulfilling emotional life. And I think, I don't want to speak on his behalf, but I think part of that is that joint inheritance of these two societies that went from being very buttoned up to opening themselves up to having to deal with certain aspects of their past that might seem shameful or difficult to reconcile. So I think there is an identification between those two cultural inheritances.
As we said earlier, Mr. Ishiguro studied at your university, the University of East Anglia, yeah. And he's actually going to be appearing at the university next week. What kind of a relationship has he had with the university over the years?
Well, over the years, he's been back. I mean, we're lucky enough at this university to have had many great writers pass through our doors, and Kazuo is one of those who very generously comes back and visits us from time to time. He's made a number of appearances at our annual literary festival. He's come back a few times to give masterclasses to our prose fiction MA students. In fact, he's going to do both of those things next week. He's going to appear at the literary festival on Wednesday evening. And then on the Thursday afternoon, he's giving a masterclass to the new intake of prose fiction writers who are doing the same course that he did in 1980. As you might imagine, those students are currently in a state of feverish excitement. So he's been hugely generous in staying in touch with the university, sharing his experience of his writing career, and joining us in a number of activities, which we're hugely grateful for.
Philip Langeskov, a lecturer in creative writing at the University of East Anglia in the UK. Well, a nervous European Union again Wednesday appealed to both sides in the dispute between the northeastern region of Catalonia and the Spanish government to negotiate their way out of a political crisis sparked by last Sunday's Catalan independence referendum. A declaration of independence could be made as early as Monday. Madrid insists that Catalonia's leadership is acting outside the law and has refused to engage in dialogue. Catalonia's regional president called for a mediated settlement of the long-standing dispute. European analyst Bruce Wilson of RMIT University's European Center in Melbourne, Australia, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Brussels is reluctant to get involved in what is viewed as an internal matter. But he said the longer the dispute goes on, pressure on the EU to step in will grow.
Spain politically is in crisis right at this time, and depending on how that crisis is resolved or not, then there could well be very serious implications for the EU more generally.
The EU is calling for mediation. Is that possible?
The Catalans themselves have been calling for mediation and for dialogue for some time, and I think the onus to address that sits very squarely with the Spanish government, which has so far refused to seek dialogue with the Catalans. This, of course, goes back for the best part of a decade that the Catalans have been seeking to renegotiate the terms of their relationship with the Spanish national constitution, and I think the time for dialogue is very, very, very much at the forefront of people's minds.
If Madrid refuses to mediate or to be involved in any kind of dialogue, and if this pushes toward violence, what might the EU have to do?
The EU is very reluctant to intrude because these are clearly internal matters to one particular member state. And in many of its programs, many of its activities, the EU has a very clear principle of subsidiarity. That is to say that it will only be engaged with those issues or principles or activities which involve more than one member state. If it were a dispute between member states, then that would be a different matter. But when it's within one member state, the EU is very, very reluctant to be involved because it is actually outside the formal powers under the European treaties. Politically, however, the more the standoff between the Spanish parties continues, the more there will be pressure on the EU to intervene in some way.
What would independence in Catalonia mean for the European Union?
Well, it would be a very serious issue. You will know that the immediate outcome of independence would be that Catalonia would be a separate nation and not a member of the European Union. The European Union has a very carefully laid out accession process for other nations to become part of the European Union, and Catalonia would be subject to exactly that same process and would have to demonstrate that it complied with all of the various preconditions that the EU sets. That is not something to be taken for granted. So in the immediate outcome, Catalonia would be a separate European nation outside the European Union. This, of course, is a serious issue because it parallels the circumstance of Scotland, and that is one of the underlying tensions of this issue, which also makes the EU very nervous.
That's Bruce Wilson of RMIT University's European Center in Australia. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This week, a gunman unloaded rounds of ammunition into a crowd of country music fans at the Route 91 Festival in Las Vegas, leaving 58 dead and more than 500 wounded. How are country artists in particular responding to the crisis? Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here with the details. Nikki, how are many of the country artists doing? Jason Aldean in particular was on stage when it happened.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think everybody is still in shock. He, along with the band and other artists that night, had to take cover backstage. Chris Young was another artist on the lineup, and he said he was on the floor of a trailer behind the stage for hours. And he said just hearing the gunshots and knowing people were being killed, it was horrifying. It was a very traumatic experience for everybody involved. I think people who were there and people who weren't. Jason Aldean, he released a statement expressing his anguish and his heartache and fear about how the world is changing and becoming more dangerous to live in, especially for him as a father raising children, and the need for us to come together as human beings and that the differences that we have are not worth our lives, that we need to stand together as one. And he also canceled several of his upcoming shows out of respect for the victims and fans and families. And I think also to provide himself and others with time to mourn. And so, as we know, country music is like one big family. And so everybody is really just trying to process and heal.
Well, many are using music as a way to heal.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's interesting. The day after the shooting, the city of Nashville, the Country Music Association, and the Nashville Convention Visitors Corporation, they hosted a candlelight vigil where artists came, like Keith Urban, Vince Gill, and Amy Grant, among others, where they shared words and they prayed and they performed tribute to the victims to really kind of help the healing process. And Maren Morris is another artist. She performed at the Route 91 Festival a day or two before. So you took about there, but the grace of God go I. And she released a song called Dear Hate. Now, she said she wrote this song 3 years ago, but the shooting compelled her to release it. And the lyrics actually start with, "Dear Hate, I saw you on the news today, like a shock that takes my breath away." And all of the proceeds go to the Music City Cares Fund, which was established to help the victims and families of the Las Vegas shooting. Other artists continue to speak out. Garth Brooks did a Facebook Live with fans offering encouragement and support. Many are pledging their commitment to performing and not being defeated. Others are performing tributes, sharing their thoughts. Dirks Bentley donated blood.
For him.
Yes, exactly. So mostly people are talking and trying to comfort one another and figuring out what to do to make a difference.
Are any artists talking about gun control legislation?
Now, this is interesting. This is major for country music because it's causing country to really take a look at that, because country music is very pro-gun. It runs deep, so much so that the National Rifle Association has a partnership with the Nashville music scene called NRA Country. So that shows how deep it goes. And I understand a lot of people, they feel like everybody has a right to bear arms. And in that, it's also a discouragement against crime. So if I'm thinking about doing something bad to you, if I think you might have a gun, you know, that can deter crime. There are many levels for reasons why people are pro-gun. But people are reconsidering. And one artist in particular, he's a guitarist. He's with the Josh Abbott Band. And he was there at the shooting. And he believes hardcore in the right to bear arms. But he, along with other members of the band and the crew, they're all licensed to carry concealed weapons. And they travel with legal firearms on tour. But he said their guns were useless against a man firing into a crowd from a distant hotel room. And he released a statement that's very powerful. Part of it says, "We couldn't touch them," meaning their guns, "for fear police might think we were part of the massacre and shoot us. A small group or one man laid waste to a city with dedicated, fearless police officers desperately trying to help because of access to an insane amount of firepower." He went on to write, "Writing my parents and the love of my life as a goodbye last night and a living will, because I felt like I wasn't going to live through the night, was enough for me to realize that this is completely and totally out of hand. These rounds were powerful enough that my crew guys, just standing in close proximity of a victim shot by this guy, or coward," he says, "received shrapnel wounds." And his experience at that festival in the midst of that shooting made him say, "We need gun control now." So this incident is making country music, the community as a whole, say, what kind of world do we want to live in? And what do we need to do to create that world? So I think it's going to cause some real soul searching in regards to this issue. Like, how can we be pro-gun, but also have gun control that makes sense and helps protect us?
You can find out more about country music, its artists, and country on VOA1's Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also reach Nikki on Twitter and Facebook at VOA1 The Hits. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Dear hate, I saw you on the news today. Like a shark that takes my breath away. You fall like rain.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late September, the government of Gaza, Hamas, announced its agreement to dissolve its governing body and allow the Palestinian Authority to assume its full responsibilities there. Hamas has also agreed to talks with the rival Fatah movement and agreed in principle to hold general elections in Gaza and the West Bank. Gaza is a self-governing Palestinian territory that was captured from Egypt by Israel during the 1967 Arab-Israeli War. In the mid-1990s, under the Oslo Accords, Israel transferred security and civilian responsibility for numerous Palestinian-populated areas of Gaza and the West Bank to the newly created Palestinian Authority, but kept control of Gaza's land and maritime borders and airspace. Since 2006, Gaza has been controlled by Hamas, which ousted the more moderate Fatah party. Hamas's stated goal since its inception has been to carry out an armed struggle against Israel. It has been a U.S.-designated foreign terrorist organization and is also designated by Israel. Therefore, since 2006, Israel and Egypt have enforced tight restrictions on movement and access of goods and individuals into and out of Gaza. The takeover of Gaza by Hamas has left the Palestinians torn between two governments, with President Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority governing autonomous areas of the West Bank. Until now, reconciliation attempts have repeatedly failed. Moving forward, in its assumption of authority over Gaza on October 3rd, the Palestinian Authority cabinet met in Gaza for the first time since 2014. The United States welcomes efforts to create the conditions for the Palestinian Authority to fully assume its responsibilities in Gaza, said White House Representative for International Negotiations Jason Greenblatt. We will be watching these developments closely while pressing forward with the Palestinian Authority, Israel, and international donors to try to improve the humanitarian situation in Gaza. The United States stresses that any Palestinian government must unambiguously and explicitly commit to nonviolence, recognition of the State of Israel, acceptance of previous agreements and obligations between the parties, and peaceful negotiations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.